You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 9, Simon Radowitzky, the Avenger of the Honor of the Humble Classes. Today I'm recording from El Defe, Distrito Federal, in Mexico. In the 19th century, Argentina was an isolated, agrarian country, for the most part, though it began to enter the world market more and more by the mid-19th century. Conversely, European immigrants started coming more and more in the 1850s. There were, of course, multiple waves, but there was a big wave of mass immigration in the 1850s. These European immigrants came from many countries, but we're talking like Italy, Eastern Europe, Germany, and when they came over, they brought their politics from back home. This included waves of leftists. The first wave of recognizable leftists came from France after the Paris Commune was smashed in 1871. Anarchists began to arrive in larger numbers by 1879. This is, of course, after the First International helped cohere the concept of anarchists as a specific political identity. These impoverished, largely Italian and Eastern European workers used mutual aid networks to protect their communities, and this in turn fueled the class struggle. These workers formed Argentina's first unions in 1887, and from that point on, socialist and anarchist organizations grew all over the country. Rent and work strikes spread the country like wildfire. A major city in Argentina, Rosario, held a general strike in 1895. There was a major wave of strikes across the country in support of an 8-hour workday in Buenos Aires in 1899. In 1901, 7,000 different groups came together to found FOA, the Federación Obrera Argentina, or the Federation of Argentine Workers. This was based on the principle of autonomy from political parties. They endorsed the tactics of general strikes, boycotts, sabotage, and rent strikes, and they also supported the construction of free libertarian schools and union hiring halls. Unfortunately, in 1902, the socialists left the FOA and formed the UGT, the Unión General de Trabajadores, or the General Workers' Union. The UGT was explicitly not anarchist or socialist. It was modeled after France's CGT, Confederation of Labor. The point of the organization was to be a neutral syndicalist movement. The FOA, in response, changed their name to FORA, or the Federación Obrera Regional Argentina, the Argentine Regional Workers' Federation. They became explicitly internationalist and rejected nation-states and borders, and they voted to make anarcho-communism the goal of their organization. Unfortunately, this split came at a bad time because Argentina's ruling class and military had made preparations to move against the workers' movement. For one thing, business owners were starting to call in the military more and more to put down strikes. On top of that, the government changed the laws in 1902 to allow deportation of activist immigrants, which was pretty much designed to short-circuit the anarchist movement, since the movement was mostly led by immigrants, right? This is part of the global First Red Scare, which in the US included the Palmer Raids. As a reminder, the Palmer Raids was when the Department of Justice basically just rounded up and deported all the Reds, even some who were not, you know, foreigners. The FBI itself was an outgrowth from this First Red Scare. In 1904, Argentina passed a labor code which legalized but limited the rights of unions. Now, in some ways, this was super progressive, because this made Argentina one of the first countries in the world to recognize and allow unions, which I must point out, unions have always been in a very gray zone legally, and unfortunately, things are headed that way again, at least in the United States. Both capital and labor rejected Argentina's new labor code. Capitalists refused to make any concessions or acknowledgement of unions whatsoever, and labor refused to be limited. But you can guess which side the state came down on in virtually every conflict. I'll give you a hint. They sided with big business. Within several years, Argentina passed a social defense law, which gave prison time for things like organizing demonstrations without a permit, using anarchist symbols, carrying out strikes, insulting the Argentine flag or national honor, and this applied in both speech and writing. The chief of police, Colonel Falcón, he was considered an officer of the old school, and he was also described as a priest of discipline. So, on May Day, 1909, Colonel Falcón ordered the military to fire upon a May Day demonstration. The police immediately killed three workers in the barrage. A Miguel Beck, who was a 72-year-old Spanish street peddler, José Silva, who was a 23-year-old Spanish shop worker, and Juan Semino, who was a 19-year-old teamster. A few hours later, Luis Pantaleon and Manuel Fernandez passed away as well. 40 workers were seriously injured. This massacre united the working class temporarily, and they came together to do a 60,000-person strong march of union members to go along with the funeral procession. The FORA and UGT unions declared a general strike. This general strike managed to secure the release of 800 imprisoned workers, but they could not force the resignation of Colonel Falcón. Now, Falcón might have been forced out, but thanks to members of the Buenos Aires Stock Exchange, who led a march to support Colonel Falcón, and the president of Argentina at the time, Presidente Alcorta, he publicly praised Colonel Falcón, thereby ensuring that he would stay in his position.
Alicia y la paloma, el buen cigarro y la mala señora, saltar paredes y abrir las ventanas, y cuando lloro una mujer. Me gusta el vino tanto como las flores y los conejos, pero no los tractores. Y el pan casero y la voz de Dolores y el mar mojándome los pies. No soy de aquí ni soy de allá, no tengo edad ni porvenir, y ser feliz es mi color de identidad. Me gusta estar tirado siempre en la arena, o en mi matungo perseguir a Manuela, o todo el tiempo para ver las estrellas con la María en el trigal. No soy de aquí ni soy de allá, no tengo edad ni por venir, y ser feliz es mi color de identidad. El sol, Alicia y la paloma, el buen cigarro y la mala señora, saltar paredes y abrir las ventanas, y cuando lloro una mujer.
On November 14, 1909, Colonel Falcón was traveling in a carriage down the Avenida Quintana, and the carriage turned onto the Avenida Callao when a young man ran from behind and threw a bomb inside the carriage. When the bomb exploded, the man began to run away, but he was pursued and shot down. When the police got to him, a journalist on the scene at the time said that the young man's face was disagreeably pale, a little reddish mustache, half-shaven, bony features, a boxer's jaws, watery eyes, and big, prominent ears. Without doubt, he is a Russian, an anarchist, and a worker. The bomber's name was Simon Radowitzky. He had survived the May Day massacre and had lived a very interesting life up to this point. He was a Ukrainian Jew who had participated in the Russian Revolution of 1905. He served a 6-month prison sentence in Kiev, and then he was forced to emigrate and flee to Argentina. By trade, he was a blacksmith and mechanic back when those two were, you know, kind of the same thing. He was just 18 years old, and he had only been in Argentina for 2 years when he was fired upon at the May Day massacre. There's a quote from the chief prosecutor about Simon Radowitzky, saying he belonged to, quote, that caste of helots who vegetated on the steppes of Russia, eking out their wretched lives among the inclemency of nature and the rudeness of an inferior status. The police and business classes in Argentina could not forgive Radowitzky for killing a Cossack, basically. At 18, Radowitzky was still considered a minor under Argentina's legal code, so he could not be sentenced to death. Radowitzky confessed to the crime, and he was obviously guilty. That's not to say he got a fair trial. Check out this old-timey race science in the prosecutor's case. And I quote, "All of the telltale signs of the criminal, undue development of the lower jaw, prominence of the zygomatic and superciliary arches, depression of the forehead, ferocious gaze, slight facial asymmetry, these are the somatic characteristics that betray Radowitzky as the classic criminal type." Now, they didn't believe him when he said he was 18. And they tried to get medical doctors to testify that Radowitzky's medical age was 22 years old. This didn't hold up, though, because they were actually able to obtain his birth certificate from the Ukraine, which proved that he was 18. No, instead of the death sentence, Simon Radowitzky was sentenced to life imprisonment. And as you might expect, he suffered multiple brutal beatings before, during, and after his trial. Now, no matter what prison he was in, Radowitzky was subjected to 20 days of solitary confinement every year on the anniversary of Falcón's assassination for the entirety of his prison sentence. And on the national level, in 1910, the president of Argentina declared martial law, and the workers' movement was further repressed. On the 16th of January, 1911, 13 convicts escaped from the National Penitentiary by tunneling under a wall. Among the escapees were two famous anarchists and 11 common criminals. Simon Radowitzky was not in on the plot, though he was in the prison at the time. The prison authorities faced public outrage and consequences for allowing the prison break, or for it happening under their watch, I guess I should say. So they blamed the prison break on Radowitzky, saying he was the mastermind, but there's no evidence to suggest that he was the mastermind. Mind you, of course, he's only like 20 at this point, right? So within the first year or two of Radowitzky's imprisonment, people began to realize that he was actually extremely well-liked by both inmates and guards. People started to describe him as a Russian mystic who, even in prison, could not imagine that men might do evil, and above all, that they should behave in a fashion injurious to their neighbors. Partially as a result of the prison break, and partially to avoid the possibility that Radowitzky might escape, the authorities transferred him to a prison at Ushai. It's both the country's southernmost city and the world's most southernmost city. It sits on a bay on the Isla Grande de Tierra del Fuego. And for those of you who don't speak Spanish out there, Tierra del Fuego is not the most inhabited, like, it's a terrifying sounding name for a place that is quite a wilderness. It was very literally Argentina's gulag, and conditions there were really not that much different from some gulags. The Argentine public basically didn't know that Ushuaia even existed until Radowitzky was sent there. Ushuaia prison was designed to hold the most savage criminals, and apart from Radowitzky, who is a special case, they sent only incorrigibles, which was defined as repeat offenders, who were on their third or more conviction. Though from this point on, there would be more and more political prisoners winding up there as well. At Ushuaia, Radowitzky was known as Prisoner 155. Reportedly, what passed for humor at Ushuaia was Simon Radowitzky asking for reading material and being given a Bible. Because he's an atheist, get it? Ironically, though, more and more he became known as a long-suffering secular saint among the inmates. From here on out, as the workers' movement stalled, and more on that in a future episode perhaps, the anarchists in Buenos Aires and elsewhere petitioned and fought for Radowitzky's rights as a political prisoner. As a side note, we see that in U.S. history, when the left stalls out, well, U.S. and German history, West German history, we see often that the leftist movements will stall out when enough of their leaders get captured, and then a lot of the energy goes into supporting and trying to free their prisoners, which is, you know, clearly a defensive move. It's not a good sign, basically, when the struggle is based around supporting people in prison. That's not to say that there can't be victories even at that stage, right, with the Provisional IRA, for example. Anyway, so these anarchists in Buenos Aires supporting Radowitzky, they would send him, you know, food and money when they could, and they petitioned for his release. They even wrote an article about his physical and sexual abuse in prison. The article was called The Sodom of Tierra del Fuego. This article made a lot of news at the time, and it got three of the rapist jailers fired after an official inquiry. On November 9th, 1918, so like 7 years later basically, Buenos Aires got news that caused more of a stir than the recent news about the Kaiser's abdication and the revolutions happening in Germany, if you could believe that. The news arrived that Simon Radowitzky had escaped on the 7th of November. Now at this point the public loved it because, first of all, he had already served like 9 years in a hard prison. Everybody knew how bad things were at Ushuaia. You know how the public can be. They love an outlaw, especially when there's any claim that the outlaw's on the right side of, you know, the law or history or what have you. But the problem was, no one had ever escaped Ushuaia, because kind of like the gulag, escaping wasn't the main problem. The main problem was surviving and getting out of Tierra del Fuego. The way Simon Radowitzky got out of prison was he dressed up as a prison guard and just walked out. They circumvented the issue of surviving Tierra del Fuego by having Radowitzky picked up by a schooner helmed by anarchists from Buenos Aires. None of the prisoners reported him missing, so the guards and the warden didn't even realize he was gone for like almost a full day. The original plan that the anarchists had was to drop Radowitzki off at a village and hide for several days and then come and pick him up later. Radowitzki wanted to go further on the first day and was thereby caught by a mobilized coast guard and a widespread manhunt. Radowitzki had 23 days of freedom before he was brought back to Ushai. The jailers waited until nighttime to bring him in to keep the convicts from rioting, but they rioted anyway. They shouted support for their mystic and screamed, "Long live Simon, death to the mangy dogs." The guards beat him savagely, and they might have killed him on this occasion, but reportedly, the guards were afraid to kill him because of the menacing and murderous protectiveness that the other inmates had for Radowitzki. So they started to punish him in different ways this time. For 2 straight years, they kept him in complete isolation, in his cell, solitary confinement, and they kept him on half rations. When Radowitzki was allowed back into the general population, he became sort of a spokesman for the prisoners, and he would often raise grievances with the warden. He also organized hunger strikes, sit-downs, work slowdowns, and chanting. Radowitzki was always singled out for reprisals. Other inmates described him as an odd sort, a Dostoevskian character, always surrounded by a mystic halo and an unfathomable predisposition for suffering. A mixture of Russian muzhik and ghetto rabbi. Always good-humored and with a cordial answer to every question. His legend was growing outside of Ushai prison as well. In 1925, a journalist was allowed to travel to Ushai and interview him. This journalist wrote, "Simon Radowitzki is a person of average height, thin, alert of face, slightly balding, with a thrusting jaw, bushy eyebrows, and small, lively eyes. His face is pale, and there are a few red veins visible in his cheeks. He is 34 years old and has spent the last 16 in prison, where he turns his hand to anything. His cell is a model of cleanliness, and it contains a few family portraits. When we meet, he is somewhat feverish and has a blue muffler wrapped around his neck. He talks readily. We might even call him loquacious, but sometimes, not being accustomed to lengthy conversations, he repeats what he has already said. He expresses himself, and from time to time the odd criollo slang slips out, but he promptly corrects himself and offers apologies. He knows that, as an anarchist, he continues to enjoy popularity, and that his fellow believers have woven him a martyr's crown. But he says that such labels irritate him, and that he did not kill Colonel Falcone to make himself famous, but rather under the prompting of his beliefs. He receives assistance from the Afinidad group in foodstuffs and medicaments, especially tonics." Unquote. By the 1930s, it was common to see graffiti in many cities in Argentina that read, "Freedom for Radowitzki." And internationally, he was often included in the same sentence as other famous prisoners like Sacco and Vanzetti. In January 1930, the ship Monte Cervantes sank near Ushai, and the survivors, mostly all rich and middle-class citizens of Buenos Aires, were put up in Ushai. The inmates shared their blankets and food, which deeply impressed the shipwrecked survivors, who brought back stories of the terrible conditions and of the inherent goodness of the prisoners. This helped shift public opinion regarding the prison. One of the main Argentine newspapers sent one of their best reporters to cover the shipwreck, and of course, while he's there, might as well cover the prison and its most notable inmate, right? So he interviewed Simon Radowitzki. In this interview, Radowitzki said, "I do want strife between bosses and workers." Referring to his assassination of Colonel Falcone, he said, "In such cases, there is always a police provocateur acting as a cat's paw. Even though I was very young at the time, I have a very vivid recollection of the pain of that tragic day, the 1st of May 1909, which brought sadness forever into many proletarian homes. I sought justice." He also said, "Yes, tell the comrade workers not to sacrifice themselves on my account. You can say, too, that I am well. Let them concentrate on other comrades, because they too deserve help, maybe more than me. Radowitzky said, I received 500 pesos a little while ago. I spread the 500 pesos around the prison's sick. One had liver trouble and needed special treatment. The other, a poor chap by the name of Andres Babi. Andres Babi was crazy. The care we obtained for them by means of that financial aid led to an improvement of the former. And now they will take Babi away to a hospice. Our library here is dismal. We need more books. What few we have, we know by heart from reading them so often. In Buenos Aires, I have a cousin called Moises. The rest of my family are in North America. I mean those linked to me by blood ties, because I also count the worker comrades who suffer the injustice of contemporary society as very much my own. Despite my incarceration, I belong to the proletarian family. My ideal of redemption endures.
Ganaron los nacionales, perdimos los españoles. Ganaron los nacionales, perdimos los españoles. Ganaron los capitales, la guerra contra los hombres. Ganaron los capitales, la guerra contra los hombres. Perdimos los españoles. Ay, capitán general de la tierra y el aire, del aire y el mar. Las cadenas son de hierro, de madera el ataúd. Las cadenas son de hierro, de madera el ataúd. Si la guerra trajo muerte, la paz trajo esclavitud. Si la guerra trajo muerte, la paz trajo esclavitud. De madera el ataúd. Ay, capitán general de la tierra y el aire, del aire y el mar. Obreros y campesinos, fusiles contra el patrón. Obreros y campesinos, fusiles contra el patrón. Es guerra contra nosotros, la paz de la explotación. Es guerra contra nosotros, la paz de la explotación. Fusiles contra el patrón. Ay, capitán general de la tierra y el aire, del aire y el mar.
President Hipólito Yrigoyen styled himself as the father of the poor, which is very, what's the word, condescending. But he did have a radical faction of his political machine which convinced him that if he pardoned Simón Radowitzky, it would help secure the vote of the workers. But Yrigoyen was worried about a military coup, which was, you know, entirely possible in Argentina at that time. Finally, on Palm Sunday, 1930, the president pardoned Simón Radowitzky along with 110 other prisoners. He was only 14 years late, because he had actually promised to pardon Radowitzky all the way back in 1916. Newspaper editions announcing his pardon sold out and became collector's items. On the 14th of May, 1930, Simón Radowitzky was released from Ushuaia. He attempted to board a ship heading to Buenos Aires, but authorities refused to let him go, and they instead put him on a ship to Montevideo, Uruguay. Now, Uruguay didn't want him either. But they have a unique tradition, almost like a Canada or Mexico, in taking in exiles. The freest country in the world, wrote one of their newspapers, and they added, the right of asylum is sacred. So Uruguay eventually allowed him to enter the country. All told, Simón Radowitzky had served 21 years for assassinating Colonel Falcón. When asked about President Yrigoyen and the pardon, Radowitzky said, my release was secured by the worldwide proletariat, and in appending his signature to it, Dr. E. Grigoyan performed an act of justice demanded by the people. And what was his life like after his release? Simon Radowitzky was nothing if not a worker, and he returned to work, working as a mechanic. In his spare time, he helped resettle Italian and Russians seeking asylum in Uruguay. Things were great for him for a few years, but then came the dictatorship of Gabriel Terra, who drove out all of the radical leftists. Radowitzky and his comrades fled to Spain. And in Spain, Radowitzky fought in defense of the Spanish Republic in the Spanish Civil War. Of course, they lost, and Simon Radowitzky had to flee over the Pyrenees into France, where he was then stuck in a concentration camp. That's right, concentration camps have a long history. The Nazis did not invent them. And the French camps holding the Spanish Civil War veterans, while they were not explicitly death camps, had horrible conditions. Simon Radowitzky was able to escape this French concentration camp, and he thereby avoided the Nazis by about a month, who definitely would have killed him. Radowitzky resettled in Mexico, Mexico City to be precise. In Mexico City, he found work in a toy factory, and he was close enough to occasionally visit his relatives in the United States. He changed his name to Juan Gomez and had a relationship with a woman, the first relationship in his life. He enjoyed a peaceful last 16 years of his life, living quietly among workers. Through this time, he stayed active in the anarchist movement and wrote for Mexican anarchist publications. He died on March 4th, 1956, when he got a heart attack, age 65, and he received a simple funeral. The Argentine Police Academy was called the Ramon El Falcón Police Academy all the way until 2011, when they renamed it to be named after a different police chief. For sources today, I used the book Rebellion in Patagonia by Osvaldo Bayer, as well as his books Simon Radowitzky and the People's Justice, and the book Expropriators. I also drew from the graphic novel Prisoner 155. Goes without saying that I can't recommend any of these books enough. I'm not sure which one I would recommend more. I mean, if you're feeling a graphic novel, obviously go with that one. I hope to do at least one more episode on these related topics. Thanks for listening, dear listener. You are already on the Patreon side, so just let people know about the show. See you next week, and God bless.
Simón nació en un tugurio de un pueblo, de un continente, como nace una simiente por una ley natural. Sin patria como el progreso, como es el arte y la ciencia, el amor y la conciencia, sin patria como el ideal.
Falcón nació en un palacio, sonriéndole la fortuna, meciéndose en blanca cuna de pequeño Napoleón. Este reconoció patrias, divisiones en la tierra, fue profesor en la guerra, coronel de la nación.
Simón como hombre de ideas, con conceptos libertarios, divulgó en los proletarios el amor y la igualdad. Una universal familia de cultos trabajadores, sin esclavos ni señores, sin leyes ni propiedad.
Cosa es libertad, concepto de libertad, profundo concepto de libertad. Hay que plantar ese concepto en cabeza de trabajador.
Falcón como buen soldado, con arcaicos oropeles, propagaba los cuarteles a la patria nacional. Y así requería patriotas debajo de su mando fueran a su voz de mando una avalancha mortal.
Ustedes tienen miedo porque nosotros no tenemos miedo.
Usted no es nada. Mire cómo viste, señor Falcón.
Usted es un lacayo que viste como aristocracia quiere que vista. Un pingüino chofer. Usted viste como ellos quieren que usted vista. Come las sobras de ellos. Pero usted no confecciona sus trajes ridículos. Trabajadores confeccionan. Usted no fabrica bigotera. Trabajadores fabrican. ¿Qué van a hacer ustedes cuando la revolución triunfe? Nada. Ustedes no son nada, no son nadie. Ninguno de ustedes. Ustedes también están al servicio de unos pocos. Deberían saberlo. Más temprano que tarde, el mundo será de trabajadores.
Pobres del mundo, el pie los esclavos sin par, alcémonos todos.